This podcast represents the views of the hosts and not the University of Texas at Austin.
This is Policy on Purpose, a podcast produced by the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. We take you behind the scenes of policy with the leaders and changemakers who help shape it. For more, visit lbj.utexas.edu/podcast. What does the future of clean energy in Texas look like? The LBJ School partnered with Canary Media and David Roberts of Volts to host an afternoon of discussions about policies shaping the clean energy transition with top experts from academia, industry, and media. LBJ faculty members Doug Lewin, Emily Beagle, and Joshua Rhodes joined Canary Media senior reporter Julian Spector for a panel discussion unpacking critical policy challenges, opportunities, and questions driving the energy future of Texas. Here's their conversation, recorded live at Bass Lecture Hall on January 28th, 2025.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming this afternoon. I'm Nicholas Rinaldi, General Manager at Canary Media.
And I'm Lisa Hymas, Executive Editor at Canary Media. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, we're really excited to be in Texas. This is our first live event in Texas. So Austin is our landing spot. Woo.
Always happy to come here.
There we go.
Thank you.
We're super excited to be here at the LBJ School. I want to thank everyone involved in putting this together. It came on really last minute. At the impetus of our friend and advisor, Evan Smith, who I know everyone here knows pretty well at the LBJ School. So thanks, Evan, who's in the audience tonight, for really pushing us to do this fantastic event. And thanks to Beverly to pulling together logistically. We're really happy to be here at the LBJ School. And thanks to Dean DeShazo for hosting us. So for those of you who don't know Canary Media, just real quick, we are a nonprofit newsroom, almost 4 years old, covering the progress and the advancement of clean energy and all the streams that go into it, from policy, innovation, technology, workforce development. And we have this live event series, Canary Live, where we go around the country to different cities and try to convene stakeholders in the climate space and energy space to share ideas, network, and hopefully advance climate solutions in your cities, regions, and communities at a more rapid pace. So we're here in Austin today doing that. We'll be in Houston on Thursday. So if you like what you see tonight, you can, you know, take the road show down to Houston with us on Thursday. And we'll have two panels. The first one will be moderated by our senior reporter, Julian Spector at Canary Media. He has an all-star lineup of your very own LBJ folks that he'll be talking about the dynamism of the Texas clean energy market. And then we'll take a short break and we'll come back with an interview with David Roberts from Volts. Let's get it started and welcome our first panel up. Julian.
Yeah, how's everybody doing today? How's it going? It's my job to like ensure safety. I need to know everyone is alive in this audience. So can we do, how's everybody doing today in Austin? Yeah, a little bit? Okay. My name's Julian Spector, as mentioned. I'm not from Austin, but my boots are, so it's good to be back here. Had a nice speaking event some years ago, and my friend who lives here took me down to South Congress and Allen's, and you know, I just remember looking at all these beautiful handcrafted boots and the stitching and the leather, and everyone's one of a kind, and I love that kind of experience. And we've got a one of a kind experience for you right here today. We've got some of the top energy experts from your school, and we're going to delve into, you know, the national outlook for clean energy this year, and then the Texas, real just dynamic market, really the biggest in the country now for building wind and solar and batteries, and but there's a lot of things up in the air now, and we're going to dig into all of that. So thank you all for being here, and we will get to some questions at the end. So if anything's sparking your curiosity, keep a note of that, and we'll get to it. So just to quickly introduce our panel here, we've got Dr. Emily Beagle, who is a researcher associated with the Weber Energy Group here, formerly worked on green hydrogen policy at the think tank RMI, and also spent some time on the Hill, right, with Tina, Senator Tina Smith, so steeped in the how the federal energy policy gets made. And then, of course, Dr. Joshua Rhodes, research scientist with Weber Energy Group as well, and founding partner at IdeaSmiths. And then Mr. Doug Lewin, who, if any of you are following energy in Texas, he's the one you go to when you got to figure out what's actually happening. You know, puts out the Energy Capital podcast and the Texas Energy and Power newsletter, and also you've taught here as well, right?
Yes. Everybody's taught last semester. I have not taught long enough to get the pin that Rhodes has. That's when I'm looking forward to getting.
Maybe
that.
We can work on that if anyone in the audience has the power to make that happen. So you know, we're coming in here right at the tail end of January, so it's still really the start of the year. A lot's happened already. So let's kick off with the national outlook for the transition to lower carbon energy. You know, obviously we have a new president in Washington who's stated that he wants to roll back a lot of the Biden era policies on this. I think a lot of people are wondering, like, is this all going to grind to a sudden halt? And you know, I want to try to demystify that a little bit. And just to kick it off, I checked on the latest outlook from the Federal Energy Information Administration. They are expecting solar to add 26 gigawatts this year and to increase total electricity generation at the end of the year by 34% compared to the year before. So that doesn't seem like a grinding halt, although it is a slower pace of construction than last year. But also wind will be up, and they're actually expecting gas generation to fall by 3% for the whole year, which was sort of surprising to me. But yeah, that's kind of like the data of where clean energy production's headed. But what are your thoughts on, you know, as we face this year, what are the key things to look for from the federal arena? And maybe do you want to take that first, because you were there most recently of all of us.
I suppose it makes the most sense for me to start on the federal policy side, as much as I might not want to, given everything that is happening. But yes, thank you, Julian. New administration, certainly a lot has happened. It's been 8 days. Some immediate actions, you know, the U.S. withdrawing again from the Paris Agreement, a number of executive orders related to energy, declaring a national energy emergency, unleashing American energy, one sort of pausing permits for offshore and onshore wind. So certainly all of those are really getting to, from the federal level, sort of setting this new vision of this energy dominance, whatever that might mean within the United States. Some key things as it relates to kind of the question of like bluster or press versus what might actually happen within those. I think the kind of the issue of permitting reform, which is interesting because it's been a bipartisan issue to try and get something like that passed, which is relevant to sort of traditional fossil fuel sources in the form of pipelines, but also for transmission needs for renewable sources as well. So the kind of maybe idea of this energy emergency executive order to unlock the ability to issue permits more quickly could be something. However, if you look at the language within that executive order, how they define energy excludes wind and solar. So not to be immediately very pessimistic, maybe there's some optimism that we could use that to accelerate, continue accelerating, or it won't be a total downside to renewables and clean energy. Those would not be included in any actions that would take place. I think there's a lot of questions about whether or not Trump can actually do that. Some other things in those executive orders, so he has called in an executive order, and then the memo from the Office of Management and Budget yesterday essentially saying one of the executive orders says we're going to stop disbursement of any funds from the bipartisan infrastructure law and also from the Inflation Reduction Act, which would have significant impacts for all sorts of different energy projects, including clean energy projects, including some other traditional energy projects. And then the memo from yesterday is just sort of a blanket pause of all federal grants and funds for anything. Within that, he says one of the ideas of that is to get rid of funds for Green New Deal socialism. So it targets a lot. Clean energy would fall underneath that. But over all of that is the question of, can he really do that? Because those are all funds that have been appropriated by Congress. So I expect that we will see, or maybe my hope is that we will see an immediate, strong, and effective response to say, no, those were already passed by Congress. You don't have the authority to unilaterally serve all of those funds. However, that certainly if does target very directly, even in rhetoric, clean energy.
And the infrastructure, of course, passed with Republican votes as well as some Democrat. That was bipartisan infrastructure. So
yes,
Okay, that's a lot. That's a lot to unpack for 7-8 days. I guess from our other panelists, any other ones you're watching? I mean, certainly there's been a lot of talk about the tax credits for clean energy, you know, investment tax credit, which is a huge part of the current business model. Are y'all worried about that, or any of those other kind of key factors underpinning the huge clean energy build out?
Well, I mean, I think a few things, you know, to put it in the broader context. I mean, we're also talking about like a massive growth in the amount of electricity consumption, whether that's, you know, previous, even before AI, although maybe after yesterday, maybe not so much. I don't know. It just seems to whiplash back and forth.
And actually, can you explain that just in case anyone was paying attention to any of the other wild headlines yesterday? There was a big development on the AI energy front.
Yeah, so there was a
potentially
maybe, fair enough.
DeepSeek.
Okay.
Everybody's following it. That was everybody. That was amazing.
It's a lot easier to know in the audience. No, you know, released a model saying that, you know, it uses a lot less energy to train, a lot less potential energy for things like inference, and so it's kind of maybe pushing back against some of the more bombastic claims on how much energy that we're going to need for our, you know, new AI overlords in the future. But I mean, that even before AI was, you know, became the new shiniest part of like the growth story, there was already electrification of transportation, electrification of heat, a lot of, a lot of the new manufacturing, the reshoring, all of those kinds of facilities, like a lot of that's highly automated and electrified. And so we already were seeing growth, you know, before AI, you know, kind of got to the party. And if you look at like all that load that we need to meet, and then you look at, okay, what do we have kind of in the queue right now to build? I mean, if you look at interconnection queues across the entire country, they're jam-packed full of, you know, a lot of mostly solar and storage and some wind and some gas, but like mostly full of renewables. And so if we need to power things now and need to build stuff now, we probably are going to need to start with the things that we've already started planning for. And so I see some momentum there that it's going to be kind of hard to push back fully against.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And there's a slide that's been floating around this week on LinkedIn and other places that NextEra had in a presentation they did that just kind of shows the different generation sources and how long it takes for them to come to market and what their costs are. And, you know, a gas plant's going to take 3, 4, or 5 years, usually more like 4 or 5. You know, nuclear, you're looking at, you know, if you're very optimistic, maybe 8 to 10 years, probably more like 10 to 12 or even more than that. You know, particularly solar and storage, you can get them online in ERCOT in 12 months, 15, 18 months, you know, in that kind of time frame. So, and Josh is exactly right. If you look at the IEA is not the EIA, but the International Energy Agency's World Energy Outlook, and in their chapter on demand, when they look globally, they're calling this the age of electricity. Demand's going to go up big time. AI data centers was 8% of that pie chart. So 92% of the growth come from other places. A lot of it is industrial electrification, which I think people are not talking about nearly enough, particularly in the state of Texas. So even if something like DeepSeek, you know, has these great efficiencies, which are, we're totally not sure about that yet. And if there's efficiencies, there might be more uses. So it could just balance out. But even if that did lead to a decline in energy demand, we're still going to see lots of energy demand. And the only way to meet that in the short term really is solar and storage. And then so I'll just say two other quick things. On the IRA, there's so much of it that's interesting, right? I mean, what's going to happen, like you said, with the clean energy tax credits and all that. The one I am like most kind of curious and fascinated with is 45X, which is the tax breaks for manufacturing, because if your agenda is America first, and if your agenda is energy dominance, and if your agenda is trying to beat the Chinese, like, you're not going to find a much better policy than 45X. So I don't see, and a lot of the manufacturing is going into deep red states, Georgia, Tennessee, South Carolina, Texas. So how that plays out is just going to be absolutely fascinating. And then last thing on this, you know, solar and storage being quick to market, the numbers are in last year in Texas, in ERCOT, developers installed a gigawatt per month of solar and storage. In the interconnection queue for 2025 is 20 gigawatts each of solar and storage. Josh can give you the stats on how many of that may actually get built. It won't be all of it, but I would not be surprised to see a lot of that built because of some of these projections of load growth. And interestingly, storage has been behind solar the last few years. I think we're starting to see signs. I just put something in my newsletter out today on this, that storage may actually pass solar and be the number one installed resource in ERCOT. I'm not yet predicting that, but I think the signs are suggestive. I'm going to hold you to it. What's that?
I'm going to hold you to it, Doug.
Dang it.
Yeah. Well, and it did say pass that out in public. What is it? The interconnection queue for ERCOT. There's now more storage in there as of, I think, November than solar.
There is more in the interconnection queue, although it is now to the point where in 2026, there's more. If you look at the 2026 bars in ERCOT's charts, there's more in 26 than in 25. They're kind of even in 25. But based on the activity of the last 60 days, where storage is outpacing solar on a 2-to-1 basis in the last 60 days, I think we're going to see 2025 storage be the more installed resource.
And that's very well. Like, so I've started my career as really an energy storage beat reporter back when no one was building it. It was hard to make a compelling story because not a whole lot was happening. And this is really a maybe 3-year-old mark, 4-year-old mark. Like go back 5 years, they're just hardly any batteries getting installed.
Winter Storm Uri, we had 200 megawatts. We're over 10,000 now, so 50x increase in 4 years.
And we'll dig into kind of what that means for the system. But I did want to, in transitioning from the federal discussion to the Texas discussion, I'm curious what significance you think Texas will have going forward in this world where it seems pretty clear we can count on federal leadership on clean energy has already basically vanished. Texas, not a state with much in the way of climate goals and policies driving action, and yet you're installing more clean energy than any of the states with the big ambitious climate goals. In some sense, this is like what the states with ambitious climate goals should be doing if they were better at achieving their ambitious climate goals is what Texas is doing. And so I'm curious how you're thinking about kind of what sort of a symbol Texas will be, or what kind of lessons Texas will have for people interested in clean energy happening across the country in this new era where it's not being led by the White House. It's kind of a conceptual one, but have y'all been thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. Like, it's easy to build things here. We talk about permit reform at kind of the national level. We make it easy to build things here, and so you make it easy to build things like wind and solar here. Then you attract the companies that want to have that energy as part of their portfolio, which then attracts more of it, and you get a kind of a virtuous kind of cycle going. I mean, I will say we also do have a good resource. Like, we have a great solar resource, we have a great wind resource. We pre-built some of the transmission, the competitive renewable energy zones. We built a lot of transmission out to West Texas, and that opened up, that unlocked a lot of, stranded energy potential out there. And it was kind of like in, Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come, and they did. And we've, since filled those in, and, now we're looking to build more transmission lines further west for electrification of the Permian and Delaware oil and gas basins, but that's also going to open up a lot other resources. And so, some of it's like, you build in the infrastructure that supports it, and then you get out of the way of the people trying to build the things, and then they do.
Yeah, and I think it's an important point as we're sort of facing down what would be a really significant shift in the federal level in terms of prioritizing or not clean energy, to think about the role that the states can and should and sort of had in the first Trump administration done to continue with those. And certainly the contrast of California versus Texas with their policies and the amount of renewables that both states have built is really interesting. And to Joshua's point, it's easy to build stuff here in Texas. And so I know from the Texas perspective, we focus, there are other reasons to build solar and wind beyond just the fact that they are clean sources that really are here in terms of the resource, the cost. Solar and storage aligns well with peak in the demand. And so sort of focusing on some of those to really maybe change the conversation while still working towards the same goals could be important going forward.
And that's a really good point about sort of the way solar and increasingly storage interacts with the peaks. Can we talk about some sort of case studies from like last summer, for instance? You had a series of heat waves, pushing the summer demand higher and higher. But there's a really marked difference this year in what that actually did to prices, right? And a lot of that has to do with these new, gigawatts and gigawatts of solar and batteries that have kind of appeared since the previous summers. But I don't know, any of you following that or want to share some kind of like what the takeaways from that experience are?
Yeah, I do just want to say, just before I get to the summer, on the Texas sort of leadership and what the rest of the country can take from here, just two quick thoughts on that. One, we don't know what the legislature is going to do this session.
Oh, and that's coming
okay,
up.
Okay, so, yeah, then we'll talk about that later. I'll leave it till later. Juicy. I think the other thing is there's real opportunity for Texas to extend that leadership. If you look at the report that came out of the Public Utility Commission on nuclear, the Advanced Nuclear Reactor Working Group, and really trying to build an industry around that in Texas, and also geothermal. Both of those industries, there's the potential to leverage the expertise, both engineering and financial and professional of all different kinds of the oil and gas industry, to help those industries. I actually just interviewed Commissioner Gladfelty for my podcast, just interviewed him today, and he chaired that committee and had the working group and had the report. And that was really what we kind of focused on in that part of the conversation, was where you're seeing a lot of oil and gas executives get involved in both nuclear and geothermal. So another place where Texas can really be a leader. And I think there's a real decision in front of the legislature. Like, do you want to try to push something down or do you want to try to build something up? And I don't think they in 140 days have time to do both. And I certainly hope, obviously, that they focus on the latter. As far as the summer, so we doubled storage in 2024. We had about 5,000 megawatts heading into 24. We finished the year with 10,000. Prices were down significantly in 24. There were multiple reasons for that. The summer was not as hot, but it was the sixth hottest summer on record. So when you, and those of you that like live in Austin, you probably wouldn't have guessed that unless you've like seen the ERCOT presentations or read my newsletter. Like we were all like, cause there's recency bias, right? Like 23 was hellish, right? So it's like, oh, 24 wasn't that bad. Turns out historically it was really bad. It was sixth worst summer ever. But compared to 23, there was a little less demand on the grid, a little less strain on the grid there. And then gas prices were overall a little bit lower, but solar and storage no doubt made a massive impact. And actually, again, in the ERCOT board materials filed yesterday and today, ERCOT put that into writing and said solar and storage did lower prices for consumers over the last year. And also not to be lost, like just huge impact on reliability, right? I mean, just day in, day out, anytime, particularly at the net peak as the sun is going down, at the peak, at our monster peaks, you have solar really producing, not at its absolute peak, but very close to it. And then as the sun goes down, storage is increasingly filling in those gaps at increasingly lower and lower prices. It's a tremendous story for both reliability and for consumers on the grid.
And I think that's important because, for folks who aren't enmeshed in this stuff, like there's this idea of like gas plants can keep chugging along however many hours you need, a battery runs out. So like, how can it be that valuable if you're, switching out a kind of 24/7 thing for a time limited thing? But seems like we're seeing it from a market basis. If it's got a limited burst of energy, but it's the exact right 2 hours in the evening that would otherwise be driving up the prices for everybody, it could have a big impact even without kind of fully one for one taking over the role from gas. So I think, yeah, that's a good, so we've established, and apparently ERCOT has now put in writing that there are real tangible, measurable benefits from having the 10 gigs of batteries suddenly, and was it like 20 something of solar now, I think?
Almost 30. Yeah,
almost 20, 30, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. Keeps changing, yep, moving target. Yeah. So let's talk about the legislative session, because you know, I think key to the success of these clean energy resources is the Texan dedication to free markets in the energy sphere, especially compared to the rest of the country. And at the same time, there seems to be this interesting tendency of the legislature to try to start, you know, getting involved in that market and putting some thumbs on scales. And it usually seems to come at the expense of the clean energy ones and in favor of the gas generators. Just an observation, but what's going on this time? It just got started. It's just down the road, right?
You want me to start?
Sure,
Doug. So yeah, I mean, there's a couple of headline bills. Senate Bill 819 would put in place one of the most restrictive permitting regimes in the country. The bill actually refers to using the police power of the state, which I think is a really interesting phrase for a conservative Republican to put into their bill. But hey, you know, they're the elected official, not me, so they can do it. That bill, a version of it, passed the Senate last time, did not pass the House. Don't know what'll happen with that this time. If a bill like that passes, the ability for ERCOT to keep the lights and, more importantly, the air conditioning in the summertime and heating in the winter on goes down precipitously. Solar and storage is being built very quickly. It is reliable with solar. It's very predictable. Of course, there's times of year where it's not, or days, weeks of the year where it's not as sunny, but you're still getting some solar output. It's a system. It's going to be interesting to hear the discussions around how, you know, gas and renewables actually can be complementary to each other. Some at the legislature get that, some don't. So we'll see. The other one, there's many that are anti-renewable, anti-storage. Another one I think worth mentioning is Senate Bill 388, which I think I've got that number right, which puts a 50% requirement for dispatchable generation, but the way they're defining it leaves storage out of it, as if storage weren't dispatchable. Of course, if you ask a grid operator, it's the most dispatchable resource there is. It responds in sub-seconds, which is why they love it for frequency control. But in the, you know, I guess, wisdom of the legislature, somehow that's not dispatchable. It's kind of a bizarre thing. I will say again, so that I'm not Dougie Downer, there are some good things happening as well. I think you'll see a big push around energy efficiency and energy waste reduction, distributed energy resources. There's also the Texas Energy Fund, which is supposed to have $1.8 billion in it for distributed energy resources at critical facilities, so that during a Hurricane Beryl or a Winter Storm Uri or following them, power stays on at hospitals and water treatment facilities and police stations, fire stations, et cetera. I mentioned nuclear earlier. There will be some kind of bill around nuclear energy fund. So again, I think the legislature has this kind of two paths thing in front of it. Like, do you want to spend all your time like really trying to put something down, which are resources that you actually need in the market for reliability and affordability as well? Or do you want to really focus on kind of what's coming next and how the state can really extend its energy leadership? Obviously, I hope that's the path they take rather than the other.
Mm. And any thoughts on those from you all? Interesting. So the Texas moving in the direction of more restrictive permitting is not what would have been on my bingo card, I guess, in any category outside of renewables, but special case. So then another, I guess before we move on from that, can you just give us a sense of the sort of political breakdown, I guess the balance of power within the legislature, and, you know, are there sort of folks who are pro-renewable and kind of go to the mat to push back on these things? And what kind of arguments are the folks trying to advance these restrictions using? And what kind of constituencies are they trying to build around that?
I mean, as far as those that like it, look, there are, and this would be a good segue to Dr. Rhodes to talk about the study that just came out last week. I mean, there are huge swaths of the state where renewables are giving huge value, $50 billion in landowner payments and tax payments from renewables. So clearly there are legislators that represent districts that have received a lot of that benefit that would rather not see it go away. And of course, you know, there's obviously 254 counties in Texas, you know, the vast majority of them are not urban, you know, megalopolises in the DFW area or in the Houston area or the Austin San Antonio corridor that's kind of becoming one over time. Like most of the state is outside of those areas, and the economic development opportunities are limited, but you do have tremendous resources there for energy production and potentially to co-locate load there. So I think there's a lot of Republicans, Democrats, both from districts like that that want it. As far as getting inside the head of the folks that don't like it, you almost have to ask them. And Canary's had great coverage. Jeff St. John has written some, like, last, if you haven't read his articles on Texas from the last session, they're still worth reading, because they kind of, it's a very similar story. And I think he had some quotes from them in there, if memory serves, but it's hard for me to understand. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like it's just a surefire way to kill the Texas economic miracle would be to shut off the spigot on renewables. I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, and that teed up your new report. So let's get into that. You were measuring economic impact of renewables and storage and kind of mapping it across the 250 some counties. What were some high level takeaways from that? This like just came out last week, I think.
Yeah, so just released a new version of a report looking at the economic impacts of renewables and energy storage across the all 254 counties in the state of Texas. We found, you know, that about 75% of counties are going to receive some benefit from renewables. For, you know, taxes associated with going to local governments for increased amount of property taxes and things like that. And if you add up the total amount of expected landowner payments for the current fleet of renewables that are out there, and also kind of what already have pretty much everything for their pretty much all their ducks in a row to be online in the next 2 to 3 years. If you look at that, and if you look at the existing fleet and the expected for landowner payments and local taxes, it's like $50 billion in over the lifetime of these projects that's expected to flow. And so that's going in to fund schools and hospital districts and, you know, road construction, kind of whatever, you know, the local tax base, you know, does support. And it also, there's a lot of that, roughly half, not exactly, but, you know, is going to landowner payments. So those that are hosting and leasing their land out to these facilities. And in the report, we also talked to folks. We talked to county judges, and we talked to school superintendents, but we also talked to landowners that have these projects. And I heard things like, you know, they're drought-proof crops. They're basically like, I can still get income from my land even if it doesn't rain for a decade, which sometimes, you know, happens in this state. And so you're seeing a lot of, I think you see a lot of support for these projects for those that are actually trying to use the land for their living, actually trying to make a living off of their land. You hardly see like any type of, or at least for the folks that we talk to, any kind of, pushback against it. But the economic impacts are massive, and they generally can come to parts of the state, as Doug said, that don't typically get, you know, the development that Austin and Houston will get. And then the other thing, the one last thing is that they're certain. It's like, I think if there's one source of energy we can all agree that we're going to use more of in the future, not less, it's electricity. Like, we can argue about all the others, but I don't really see a future where we use less electricity. And you know, these payments for these renewable energy and storage facilities, they're mapped out. You know what you're going to make next quarter, and you know what you're going to make, you know, quarter three of 2033. And that makes it a lot easier to do long-term planning, whether you're a local government or you're a ranch owner, if you know how much income you're going to be able to get off of these things versus, you know, whatever OPEC decides to do with, you know, oil, you know, halfway around the world affecting your revenues.
Yeah, no, and that's a kind of fascinating dynamic there, because obviously the owner of the plant or the sort of developer has to, they've got some market risk and they're the ones in ERCOT and that kind of thing. But for the landowner, you just sign a contract with spelling out all the payments, you know, regularly over time, and you just don't have to worry about that risk. So speaking of billion-dollar economic impacts, let's talk about hydrogen, one of your expertise areas, Emily. And I did a sort of road trip through the Gulf Coast at the end of 2023 for Canary, reporting on this kind of potential hydrogen boom, and the idea being, you know, if you can make clean hydrogen as opposed to the pretty carbon-intensive hydrogen we make today, that could decarbonize all these heavy industry tasks and types of heavy transportation that otherwise might be hard to do with batteries and electrification. And, you know, the Houston Gulf Coast corridor is uniquely suited to actually make this happen, because it's already a huge hub for hydrogen production around the petrochemical facilities. So I talked to a lot of developers just now a year and a half ago or so. There's all these grand visions. They got a billion-dollar hub grant from the Department of Energy. And in the intervening time, I don't think a single thing's gotten built. So can you walk us through, you know, is this potential hydrogen boom actually a real thing for Texas economic development? Or, you know, are we going to be waiting around for it for another 5-10 years or more?
Yeah, great question. So yeah, $8 billion in the infrastructure bill that went to developing regional clean hydrogen hubs. 7 of those were awarded across the United States, including one in the Texas Gulf Coast. And so sort of what happened in the interim from the big announcement with all of the hope of, you know, Texas was selected for an over $1 billion award to build this hydrogen hub was the actual negotiations about the distribution of that award between DOE and the main contractor and then the contractor and all of sort of the subcontractors. So UT is on that Texas Hydrogen Hub project. The Weber Group is part of that as well. So we're sort of a subcontractor.
All roads lead back here.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So that's one of the reasons why there was all of this hype and excitement and then not a lot of stuff happened, because it's just the standard part of a process. And it would make sense that if you're getting ready to start, the total length of that hub project is 12 years across multiple phases. So if you're getting ready to spend 12 years on a project, $1 billion of taxpayer funds, the contracts associated with that, because these are such massive hubs, it's sort of one of the cool things out of the infrastructure bill were these hub designs. So in addition to the hydrogen hubs, there were also direct air capture hubs, which is sort of the first time that the Department of Energy was really aiming to do large scale sort of liftoff commercial technology type projects rather than maybe lab scale basic research like they had done in some tech development. So a really fundamental shift that had to happen at the Department of Energy to establish their Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations, which is where a lot of these projects are housed. So all that to be said, that sort of that interim time between when the hub announcements happened and sort of where we are now, there was stuff going on. It was just all that stuff behind the scenes. So the Texas Hub finalized their contract with DOE at the end of last year, and that was all very, very exciting. And then I will have to be, I guess, the Debbie Downer, because then I have to come back to where we are now, which was that we had, I know.
Do you know if the check got cashed?
I was sort of under the assumption and had heard that any awards that had been signed, like contracts that had been signed, were safe for anything that might have happened at the start of the Trump administration. In the memo that came out yesterday, one of the sort of clauses of that says that this pause includes awards that have already been granted, like the cancellation of some of those awards. So that really caught me off guard. I think it's caught everything that has happened, but is catching everybody off guard. But in particular, that really raises a lot of questions, not just about the hydrogen hub here in Texas, but more broadly, because again, I don't think that the president can do that, but
it gets to kind of fundamentals of contracts, like in a society where you finalize a contract and there's companies planning their investments based on that, and then to say that signature doesn't mean anything. It throws a kind of like a lot of basic economic principles into question. Right?
Yes. So, I mean, I expect it will very much be challenged. The delays that might cause are yet to be seen. Another important part related to hydrogen are there are two tax credits. There's the 45V clean hydrogen production tax credit, and then also the 45Q carbon capture tax credit from the Inflation Reduction Act, which are also really significantly spurring hydrogen development, not just in Texas, but more broadly. And so those are similarly kind of being called under question in as we're trying to figure out what it means that the funds from kind of both of those major pieces of legislation. All that to be said, should things continue as we were sort of expecting them to continue even kind of mid-December with the start of this contract, you alluded to Texas being a fantastic place to develop the hydrogen economy. We produce about a third of all of U.S. hydrogen here. It's a great opportunity as one of those industries where we could transition all of the workforce capacity that we have in the oil and gas sector to a new sector. It could really help us decarbonize a lot of the really heavy industry and chemicals that we have here in Texas, too. So I am very cautiously optimistic that all of that will continue. And I think if we are to see those projects continuing, Texas still has all of those advantages to see that going forward, and a lot of enthusiasm from industry as well, and global momentum for hydrogen that I think will help drive some of that too. The economics opportunity there can really be a driving argument for hydrogen.
Just quickly on hydrogen, and what Dr. Beagle just said about the workforce. So it's, I think, important to remember that the oil and gas industry in Texas before the sort of mini bust of 2014 had about 300,000 workers in it. The oil and gas production went up, went down again, went up again. Even on its up trajectory, it has not reached 200,000 jobs. So basically a lot of that's automation. And as AI develops, we're probably going to see a whole lot more jobs shed in the industry. So it is, whatever your view of the world is, if you're any sort of Texas leader and you care about oil and gas workers at all, having that kind of diversification is very important. And just the last thing on this, I think it's very important. The Railroad Commission convened a hydrogen, what did they call it? The Hydrogen Development.
Hydrogen Production Council.
Policy Council, something like that. And one of the things they put in there was there is an increasing market overseas for low carbon oil and gas resources, including potentially clean hydrogen. And so as the administration is making these decisions about what they cut, I think they're going to end up hearing a lot from the oil and gas industry. And of course, the Houston High Velocity Hydrogen Hub, ExxonMobil and Chevron are two of the major partners. So, you know, if they think they're like hurting the greenies or something, they've got it all wrong, but I don't know how much they're thinking that through, honestly.
and I guess just briefly, if I don't know if we can say this definitively, but let's say a lot of that federal support does get blocked up and doesn't end up flowing. I mean, is there any fundamental economic reason to be producing clean hydrogen here absent a very remunerative federal policy regime? Like, it, you know, Europe needs it. They've got strong policy. Could you see a world where it makes sense for Texas companies to invest in it even without, you know, someone like President Biden in office?
I think to meet some of the global export demand for hydrogen, those will be driven by a desire and policies to decarbonize, and they'll have clean hydrogen standards, but that could definitely be one way, and Texas is situated to be an export. We export molecules already. Why not make it clean hydrogen?
And Emily, on the there is a lot of demand in the state as well, isn't that? I think High Velocity is kind of focused on the... Is it 3 million metric tons of like gray hydrogen or whatever? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And part of the project is to look at demonstrating use of hydrogen in new sectors too. So like heavy duty transportation is one of the sectors that they've targeted, replacing some industrial heat needs with clean hydrogen. So yeah, demonstration of new, but yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Cool. Well, I want to get into the kind of keeping up with load growth topic that we alluded to a few times. And so let's do a few more minutes of that and then maybe like 10 minutes of questions, you know, before the hour is up. So be thinking about your questions. And we've got these mics down here. Or, you know, if you can't get down there, raise your hand and we can get a mic up to you. But before that, you know, we've talked about electricity demand almost certainly will be higher in the future, and we don't know exactly how high. We don't know exactly how much the AI is going to need or not need. Seems to change by the day lately. Is there a world where whatever this new growth is met in a way that keeps the clean energy transition moving and keeps total emissions from the power sector going down? Or are these kind of climate goals at risk of being like thrown out the window, you know, in this rush to like get whatever power source you can to keep the growth going?
I mean, I think in some of the, I think there might be like a short term and kind of like a long term, like look at that. I mean, I think kind of in the short term, you know, if we add all of this load right now, we're probably going to supply a good chunk of that with, you know, slack that we have in the system. And a lot of our renewables are so cheap that they're already the thing that are flowing into the electricity grids. And you know, you have, I looked at this few years ago, it's probably changed now, but like the average capacity factor of a natural gas plant in the US was like 40% or something like that. So, you know, that doesn't mean that there's not times of the day that they're all that a lot of them are running, but there is more capacity there, or there's more energy at least available there, is like probably the better way to say that. So I think there's a difference in kind of like the short term versus the long term, because of how cheap renewables are. I mean, I think they're going to be you know, dispatched first. And so if we see this like step change in the amount of demand or growth, you know, we'll probably take it up with the slack that we have.
Well, that's kind of hopeful, actually, right?
Like, well, not from an emissions perspective.
Well, not from like a short-term emissions perspective, but like then a longer term, I think it can spur more of that growth. But I mean, I think like, I think even a pure market structure is only going to pull it to a certain extent. Like, I mean, if you want to get to 100% clean, I mean, there's going to have to be policy to pull that.
Mm-hmm. And then, are there potential upsides in sort of this like juggernaut of demand breaking through barriers and fast tracking clean energy development, just because like they need anything and you know, the timelines are beneficial to solar. Like I saw in, I think, New York Times today, had a Chevron saying they want to get into building gas power plants for like AI customers, but you know, they've got the equipment, but they can get something in maybe 3 years, you know, if they really get on it. And you could, as you said, build solar battery like a lot faster. So is there, you know, we've talked about these forces trying to kind of hold back the pace of renewable development. But I wonder if this like insatiable industrial demand could be a countervailing force on that, or is that just wishful thinking?
I mean, we saw a lot of really interesting stuff happen towards the end of last year as it related to almost a nuclear renaissance spurred by major tech companies trying to do just that, like find how they were going to meet this new electricity demand in the context of their commercial, their own internal goals that they had for clean energy. And so if they maintain those goals, I'm really, maybe that will be the optimism that I add to this conversation, excited about what just companies themselves with those goals could do to drive some of these new technologies.
Yeah, I'm excited for a nuclear renaissance, because the last nuclear renaissance didn't renaissance enough.
You
know? I think the other thing to keep an eye on here in Texas is there will be legislation around large loads. We don't know exactly what that's going to look like, but what exactly that looks like will go a long way to answering your question as far as whether or not Texas is a place where we continue to see lots of growth of clean energy, and probably through like the Texas Energy Fund. You know, the Texas Energy Fund, which, if you don't know what that is, it's a fund the legislature set up mostly to fund new gas plants. And what they got out of that, I think 80 or 90% of the applications funded are peakers, right? So combustion turbines and that kind of thing. So I think what you if there was like, you know, some like logic, involved in all this, if we give, which is a big if, I get it. I think what you'd probably see is some, you're talking about like speeding up permitting and the speeding up the entry for the large loads that bring generation with them, that maybe pay part of their transmission, that bring some not only clean energy, but also like backup power and are willing to curtail during times like a winter storm Uri or when there's a shortage, or September 6th, when 2023, when there was a shortage on the grid, we had an energy emergency in those kinds of times, like giving them preferential treatment so that we're getting the loads that are actually like being good citizens on the grid. Something like, I think those kinds of discussions are going to be endlessly fascinating during this session.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that like there's been, it's been a bit harder is getting kind of like the firm clean sources of energy out there. They've been a bit, you know, more expensive than the existing, you know, technologies that we have. But if this is where the buckets of money come from, like these companies to actually do the R&D to get this stuff going. I mean, I think that'd be my optimistic, great result, like from this like huge, like jolt in demand. If AI compute is so valuable that they're willing to like pay the money to like to get these technologies across the finish line or get them to the technology readiness levels that we need them to be at, like that would be great.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's arguably the most optimistic we've sounded this whole hour. So let's go to questions on that. Got the mics on either side, and please maybe say your name and nice succinct question and direct it to whoever you want to or the whole group. Yeah.
Yeah. My name's Eric. And if you were an advisor to a top Republican in D.C. that had the presidency here and you believe in climate change, but you're not allowed to say that, what would you advise, you know, your boss to try to get done?
An advisor to a Republican who's what?
Who believes that climate change is a threat, but, you know, you can't say that out loud. So what would you try to accomplish as that Republican who knows this is a problem but has to work, you know, within the system that we've got for a few years?
I mean, I would think I would focus on some of the co-benefits. So what Joshua was talking about in terms of the economic development that has come to a lot of the counties in Texas also applies on the federal level. I think recent report found that more than half of the funds from the Inflation Reduction Act and infrastructure bill are going to Republican districts.
It's like 80%.
It's more like 80%. Yeah, something like much that. More yeah. than, yeah. Yeah. So I think focusing on those, I mean, and I think if you want to talk about energy security and domestic energy, then wind and solar are those things. And so if there's a way to make that a salient argument as well, again, who knows if that would actually be the case, but that's
not,
what I would
they're
try.
They're not energy in the new executive definition of energy.
That's very true. That's the first thing we need to do.
I mean, I had a piece in the Dallas Morning News a few weeks ago where I basically made the argument that we should double down on renewables because that allows us to export more of our natural gas and have more of like a, you know, a policy push in the rest of the world to use as a lever. So I don't know. It allows us to basically save it for, you know, for to be able to use that for influence in the world.
Don't get high on your own supply.
Right.
I wouldn't say that to the Republican in DC, but, I think the main things though, for real though, are competitiveness, national security, right? Grid reliability, particularly when you're talking about solar and storage, particularly when you talk about monster heat waves, jobs and economic development, right? I think would be, another one to Dr. Beagle's point, 80% of the IRA and BIL projects happening in Republican districts. Those are all
China from the crowd. That's a
yeah. China, national security. Absolutely. All of that. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. We're here.
Hi, I'm Shashwati. I'm a chemical engineering PhD student at UT. So I wanted to dug a little more in this industrial electrification thread. It's something I work on day in and day out. And when I think of the industrial sector, like this is a sector that is not powered by electricity today. It is really dependent on process heat. And so I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more about where you see both the growth and also just like excitement in industrial energy kind of changing in the future. And I do really think we need to be talking more about this. So, yeah.
Thanks for the question. You want to start? You want me to start?
Maybe you want to start on the, I don't know, industrial electrification as much.
So, well, just a couple examples. I mean, I believe we now have at least one, if not two, steel mills in Texas that are electrified. There's an LNG export facility. I believe it's the Freeport one that is grid connected, 700 megawatt load. Oil and gas, I mean, the Permian Basin Reliability Plan, which will be discussed at the ERCOT board meeting next week and has been moving now since House Bill 5066 passed in 2023. That's happening because six oil and gas companies hired S&P to do a study of their electric demand and found their demand in the Permian was somewhere in like the, I can't remember exactly, it was like 10 to 12 gigawatts or something like that. And only three or four of that was grid connected. And they want to be grid connected because that lowers the input costs of producing a barrel of oil, which oil's gone up a little bit recently, but like most of last year, it was $65-$70 according to the Federal Reserve of Dallas to produce a barrel of oil in the Permian cost between $63 and $70. So if you're kind of like right at the break-even point for a new well, anything you can do to lower your costs is a good thing. And diesel gensets, that's a really expensive way to make power. So the oil and gas industry wants to connect to the grid mostly to buy cheap renewables. So I think this part of the thing that drives me crazy at the legislature, I think a lot of the legislators think they're doing something for oil and gas by hurting renewables. They're actually hurting oil and gas too. Basically any industrial application, and hopefully Dr. Rhodes and Dr. Beagle can talk about this more because you'll reach the limits of my knowledge pretty quickly because I am in no way, shape or form an engineer, but like the low heat industrial applications, which are a lot of them, are much easier to electrify and are in fact already electrifying. When I interviewed Commissioner McAdams for my podcast after he left the commission, and I asked him what he learned after Winter Storm Uri, what kind of surprised him, and he was like, we didn't realize at the time of Winter Storm Uri how much industrial load had already electrified. This is pre-2021, just because it's cheaper.
Yeah, I'll maybe just add that the industrial sector is so incredibly complicated. And so as we think about how to decarbonize it, there is not one solution. And being able to think about what the conditions are under which electrification makes sense, lower temperature heat, as Doug mentioned too, versus when we might need to look at something else like hydrogen is going to be a really, really important part of that question. And that as we sort of see that sector coming to more prominence as one that we need to decarbonize, hopefully can have more nuanced conversations rather than kind of talking about it as is the one answer for industrial decarbonization, because that's just not the case. It's far too diverse. It's far too complicated.
And also my colleague Maria Gallucci at Canary Media does a lot on that kind of industrial heat. Some really good articles up there.
You guys had a whole series on it, by the way, which I would highly recommend. It's a great series. I learned a lot.
It's a fun series. So let's pop over here, and then I think we can get to everyone who's standing, and then I'll probably hand over the reins.
Hi. I'm Doug. I went to the LBJ school, so I'm really glad that y'all are here. Thank you.
Hello, fellow Doug.
Oh, great.
Stay together. Dougs of the world unite.
But I know that we've talked a lot about the different technologies involved here in terms of prime movers and whatnot. Do you all foresee anything changing in terms of market-based reforms, whether it be deregulation, re-regulation, anything tipping the scales like y'all had alluded to earlier in terms of I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Interesting. Anything in Texas or more broadly nationally?
Go for both.
Okay. Yeah.
Go for both. Yeah, because it was such a short answer already. You want me to start?
Sure, go ahead.
I mean, in Texas, this does get floated from time to time. Last session, there was a big fight over something called the performance credit mechanism, which I won't try to explain right now, but it was basically shifting us from an energy-only market to a capacity market. And some of the manufacturers floated the idea of like that would be such a mess and such a convoluted system, they'd rather just re-regulate. And I do think you hear that talk from time to time from certain legislators will bring it up. But I think is my view of the world, and I think I could back it up with data. We don't have enough time to get in all the data right now, but I think that competitive markets generally work. There are market failures, and those have to be addressed. And those are addressed through things like ancillary services, energy efficiency programs. Like there's lots of market failures that have to be addressed with policy. I'm not it's not some weird libertarian point of view, but I just think that there are benefits from market dynamism and competition. And we continue to see that in Texas, where we're attracting more investment and power generation than any other part of the country, including where they're paying large capacity payments. So, you know, but will there be market reforms? Will they change things? Yes, it's always going to change. It's always going to evolve. And sometimes that's frustrating, but that's just the nature of it. But I think at its core, the energy only market delivers a lot of value. And we're really talking about turning the dials around the edges rather than, you know, upsetting the whole apple cart.
And there's almost a question of like, can other states pull over some of these ideas in the interest of spurring clean energy, but that's a whole other
or in the interest of lowering costs for their consumers. And I would say they should. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good answer for that one. If that's acceptable. Do you want to lightning round on these two?
Well, my name's Steve. The Biden administration, put out a rule about fining, methane leaks at wellheads, oil and gas drilling, and state of Texas so far, Wayne Christian, who's at the Railroad Commission, wrote the TCEQ, the environmental agency, saying we need to stop anything that would prevent a methane leak. And then Ken Paxton's joined with, I think, 22 other state attorney generals to try to block the implementation of this rule. And it just seems short-sighted to be editorializing here, because whether it's a rule or it's like a tax credit for doing it, this is like low cost, high impact to capture this product that is otherwise flared or vented. And it's highly destructive to climate. So I guess trying to just give y'all something there. I just thought the audience in general ought to know about this. Maybe you have a comment, maybe you don't. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe quick thoughts. Is it going to survive or not? Or do we know yet?
I mean, to your point, kind of the logic of, is this is what you are producing and then you can sell it. Why would you want to just leak it and like just throw money on the ground? I guess that doesn't make any sense to me. So I see that. I mean, that is, of all of the many things that were in the Inflation Reduction Act, a lot of those were carrot style tax credits, with the exception of the methane fee. There were some funds in the infrastructure law to help sort of support and fund the retrofits needed to reduce leaks. But I mean, that if there was one thing, if Republicans were going to go take a kind of scalpel through, it would probably be that, unfortunately, because I do think it is an issue that needs to be solved. So thank you for raising that.
Okay, last one.
This will be much less technical. And if I can just speak, I'm Emma, I'm an undergraduate at UT, and I'm speaking on behalf of students here. The issues that you all identified in the beginning that have been made over the past few days, 8 days, have made me feel a lack of agency in a lot of my peer group. What would you all recommend that we can do in the meantime to take action on the things we care about while we're still in school?
I had a conversation with a friend of mine who is in DC, works at the National Academies of Sciences, and his advice was focus on your locus of control. Where are you and what can you do in your local areas? I think there will be a lot of action that can come from jurisdictions like Austin, from UT, from states, and then don't board the train of despair were the two things that he told me yesterday. So that's what I will pass along.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this too will pass. But I mean, get out there and like, you know, learn the things while you're here that, you know, you can use to, you know, affect policy later, or whether that's engineering or policy or regulatory, whatever it is, like take advantage of the time you're here to learn from the folks, you know, from the professors and, you know, from the peers, like, because, you know, That's how you will affect change.
Yeah, both great comments. And I think, yes, locus of control, but also your locus of influence, right? And think about like where you can make a difference and understand that there's a lot outside of there, and you need to know to be an informed citizen what's going on out there, but you want to spend most of your time on those circles where you can control and influence. And I'll just throw in one other like piece of advice that I think is good, regardless of what's going on, like politically, economically, you know, I mean, climate change is going to be with us for our lifetimes. And it's like the LA fires, we just saw there's going to be just countless examples going forward. Draw on the deep well of wisdom and philosophy that exists, right? When you're at a university, like you should be able to take lots of different classes and build up that base of learning in your life that you want to build on throughout your life, right? Because you can't just deal with this by studying hydrogen and solar and storage. You also have to like understand how to actually like process the pain and the hurt of those things and you actually use that as fuel to do good in the world. So there's a lot more I could say on that, but we'll stop.
What a way to end it. That was perfect closing question. So wait, can you all stand up? I want to get these out of the way and let's stand up and then we can give them a very well-deserved round of applause. Thank you.
This is Policy on Purpose, a podcast produced by the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. We take you behind the scenes of policy with the leaders and changemakers who help shape it. For more, visit lbj.utexas.edu/podcast. For photos and a recap of these clean energy discussions, including a fireside chat with Volt's founder and journalist David Roberts, and Austin Energy executive leaders Lisa Martin and Michael Emger, go to the news section on our website, lbj.utexas.edu. And be sure to follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram at the LBJ School. Thank you for listening.